Chapter 16. It was on our return from that first trip that I took Dominic up to the villa to be presented to Dona Rita. If she wanted to look on the embodiment of fidelity, resource, and courage, she could behold it all in that man. Apparently she was not disappointed. Neither was Dominic disappointed. During the half-hour's interview they got into touch with each other in a wonderful way, as if they had some common and secret standpoint in life. Maybe it was their common lawlessness and their knowledge of things as old as the world. Her seduction, his recklessness, were both simple, masterful, and, in a sense, worthy of each other. Dominic was, I won't say awed by this interview. No woman could awe Dominic. But he was, as it were, rendered thoughtful by it, like a man who had, not so much an experience as a sort of revelation vouchsafed to him. Later, at sea, he used to refer to La Senora in a particular tone, and I knew that henceforth his devotion was not for me alone. And I understood the inevitability of it extremely well. As to Dona Rita, she, after Dominic left the room, had turned to me with animation and said, Uddy is perfect, this man. Afterwards she often asked after him, and used to refer to him in conversation. More than once she said to me, one would like to put the care of one's personal safety into the hands of that man. He looks as if he simply couldn't fail one. I admitted that this was very true, especially at sea. Dominic couldn't fail. But at the same time I rather chaffed Rita on her preoccupation, as to personal safety, that so often cropped up in her talk. One would think you were a crowned head in a revolutionary world, I used to tell her. That would be different. One would be standing then for something, either worth or not worth dying for. One could even run away then, and be done with it. But I can't run away, unless I got out of my skin and left that behind. Don't you understand? You are very stupid. But as he had the grace, to add comma on purpose. I don't know about the on purpose. I am not certain about the stupidity. Her words bewildered one often, and bewilderment is a sort of stupidity. I remedied it by simply disregarding the sense of what she said. The sound was there, and also her poignant heart-gripping presence giving occupation enough to one's faculties. And the power of those things over one there was mystery enough. It was more absorbing than the mere obscurity of her speeches. But I dare say she couldn't understand that. Hence, at times, the amusing outbreaks of temper in word and gesture that only strengthened the natural, the invincible force of the spell. Sometimes the brass bowl would get upset, or the cigarette box would fly up, dropping a shower of cigarettes on the floor. We would pick them up, re-establish everything, and fall into a long silence, so close that the sound of the first word would come with all the pain of a separation. It was at that time, too, that she suggested I should take up my quarters in her house in the street of the consuls. There were certain advantages in that move. In my present abode my sudden absences might have been in the long run subject to comment. On the other hand, the house in the street of consuls was a known outpost of legitimacy. But then it was covered by the occult influence of her who was referred to in confidential talks, secret communications, and discreet whispers of royalist salons as Madame de l'Astéola. That was the name which the heiress of Henry Alliger had decided to adopt when, according to her own expression, she had found herself precipitated at a moment's notice into the crowd of mankind. It is strange how the death of Henry Alliger, which certainly the poor man had not planned, acquired in my view the character of a heartless desertion. It gave one a glimpse of amazing egoism in a sentiment to which one could hardly give a name, a mysterious appropriation of one human being by another, as if in defiance of unexpressed things and for an unheard of satisfaction of an inconceivable pride. If he had hated her, he could not have flung that enormous fortune more brutally at her head. And his unrepentant death seemed to lift for a moment the curtain on something lofty and sinister like an Olympian's caprice. Dona Rita said to me once with humorous resignation. Uno, it appears that one must have a name. That's what Henry Alliger's man of business told me. He was quite impatient with me about it. But my name, amigo, Henry Alliger had taken from me like all the rest of what I had been once. All that is buried with him in his grave. It wouldn't have been true. That is how I felt about it. So I took that one. She whispered to herself. Asteola, not as if to test the sound, but as if in a dream. To this day I am not quite certain whether it was the name of any human habitation, a lonely casario with a half-effaced carving of a coat of arms over its door, or of some hamlet at the dead end of a ravine with a stony slope at the back. It might have been a hill for all I know, or perhaps a stream, a wood, or perhaps a combination of all these. Just a bit of the earth's surface. Once I asked her where exactly it was situated and she answered, waving her hand cavalierly at the dead wall of the room. H, over there. I thought that this was all that I was going to hear, but she added moodily, I used to take my goats there, a dozen or so of them, for the day. From after my uncle had said his mass till the ringing of the evening bell. I saw suddenly the lonely spot, sketched for me some time ago by a few words from Mr. Blunt, populated by the agile, bearded beasts with cynical heads, and a little misty figure dark in the sunlight with a halo of disheveled rust-colored hair about its head. The epithet of rust-colored comes from her. It was really tawny. Once or twice in my hearing as he had referred to why rust-colored hair with laughing vexation. Even then it was unruly, abhorring the restraints of civilization, and often in the heat of a dispute getting into the eyes of Madame de Lasteola, the possessor of coveted art treasures, the heiress of Henry Alliger. She proceeded in a reminiscent mood, with a faint flash of gaiety all over her face, except her dark blue eyes that moved, so seldom out of their fixed scrutiny of things invisible to other human beings. The goats were very good. We clambered amongst the stones together. They beat me at that game. I used to catch my hare in the bushes. Your rust-colored hare, I whispered. Yes, it was always this color. And I used to leave bits of my frock on thorns here and there. It was pretty thin, I can tell you. There wasn't much at that time between my skin and the blue of the sky. My legs were as sunburned as my face, but really I didn't tan very much. I had plenty of freckles, though. There were no looking glasses in the presbytery, but Uncle had a piece not bigger than my two hands for his shaving. One Sunday I crept into his room and had a peep at myself. And wasn't I startled to see my own eyes looking at me. But it was fascinating, too. I was about 11 years old then, and I was very friendly with the goats, and I was as shrill as a cicada and as slender as a match. Heavens! When I overhear myself speaking sometimes, or look at my limbs, it doesn't seem to be possible. And yet it is the same one. I do remember every single goat. They were very clever. Goats are no trouble really, they don't scatter much. Mine never did, even if I had to hide myself out of their sight for ever so long. It was but natural to ask her why she wanted to hide, and she uttered vaguely what was rather a comment on my question. It was like fate. But I chose to take it otherwise, teasingly, because we were often like a pair of children. Oh, really, I said, you talk like a pagan. What could you know of fate at that time? What was it like? Did it come down from heaven? Don't be stupid. It used to come along a cart track that was there, and it looked like a boy. Wasn't he a little devil, though? You understand, I couldn't know that. He was a wealthy cousin of mine. Round there we are all related, all cousins as in Brittany. He wasn't much bigger than myself, but he was older, just a boy in blue breeches, and with good shoes on his feet, which of course interested and impressed me. He yelled to me from below, I screamed to him from above, he came up and sat down near me on the stone, never said a word, let me look at him for half an hour, before he condescended to ask me who I was. And the airs he gave himself. He quite intimidated me sitting there perfectly dumb. I remember trying to hide my bare feet under the edge of my skirt as I sat below him on the ground. Qu'est comique, eh? She interrupted herself to comment in a melancholy tone. I looked at her sympathetically, and she went on. He was the only son from a rich farmhouse 2 miles down the slope. In winter they used to send him to school at Tolosa. He had an enormous opinion of himself. He was going to keep a shop in the town by and by, and he was about the most dissatisfied creature I have ever seen. He had an unhappy mouth and unhappy eyes, and he was always wretched about something. About the treatment he received, about being kept in the country and chained to work. He was moaning and complaining and threatening all the world, including his father and mother. He used to curse God, yes, that boy, sitting there on a piece of rock like a wretched little Prometheus with a sparrow peeking at his miserable little liver. And the grand scenery of mountains all round, ha, ha, ha. She laughed in contralto. A penetrating sound with something generous in it, not infectious, but in others provoking a smile. Of course I, poor little animal, I didn't know what to make of it, and I was even a little frightened. But at first, because of his miserable eyes I was sorry for him, almost as much as if he had been a sick goat. But, frightened or sorry, I don't know how it is, I always wanted to laugh at him too, I mean from the very first day, when he let me admire him for half an hour. Yes, even then I had to put my hand over my mouth more than once for the sake of good manners, you understand. And yet, you know, I was never a laughing child. One day he came up and sat down very dignified a little bit away from me, and told me he had been thrashed for wandering in the hills. To be with me? Apostrophe apostrophe I asked. And he said, to be with you? No. My people don't know what I do. Apostrophe apostrophe I can't tell why, but I was annoyed. So instead of raising a clamor of pity over him, which I suppose he expected me to do, I asked him if the thrashing hurt very much. He got up, he had a switch in his hand, and walked up to me, saying, I will soon show you. Apostrophe apostrophe I went stiff with fright, but instead of slashing at me, he dropped down by my side, and kissed me on the cheek. Then he did it again, and by that time I was gone dead all over, and he could have done what he liked with the corpse, but he left off suddenly, and then I came to life again, and I bolted away. Not very far. I couldn't leave the goats altogether. He chased me round, and about the rocks, but of course I was too quick for him in his nice town boots. When he got tired of that game he started throwing stones. After that he made my life very lively for me. Sometimes he used to come on me unawares, and then I had to sit still and listen to his miserable ravings, because he would catch me round the waist and hold me very tight. And yet, I often felt inclined to laugh. But if I caught sight of him at a distance and tried to dodge out of the way he would start stoning me into a shelter I knew of, and then sit outside with a heap of stones at hand, so that I daren't show the end of my nose for hours. He would sit there and rave, and abuse me till I would burst into a crazy laugh in my hole, and then I could see him through the leaves rolling on the ground, and biting his fists with rage. Didn't he hate me? At the same time I was often terrified. I am convinced now that, if I had started crying he would have rushed in and perhaps strangled me there. Then as the sun was about to set he would make me swear that I would marry him when I was grown up. Swear, you little wretched beggar, apostrophe he would yell to me. And I would swear. I was hungry, and I didn't want to be made black and blue all over with stones. Oh, I swore ever so many times to be his wife. 30 times a month for 2 months. I couldn't help myself. It was no use complaining to my sister Therese. When I showed her my bruises, and tried to tell her a little about my trouble she was quite scandalized. She called me a sinful girl, a shameless creature. I assure you it puzzled my head so that, between Therese my sister and Jose the boy, I lived in a state of idiocy almost. But luckily at the end of the 2 months they sent him away from home for good. Curious story to happen to a goat herd living all her days out under God's eye, as my uncle the cura might have said. My sister Therese was keeping house in the presbytery. She's a terrible person. I have heard of your sister Therese, I said.
Oh, you have?
Of my big sister Therese, 6, 10 years older than myself perhaps? She just comes a little above my shoulder, but then I was always a long thing. I never knew my mother. I don't even know how she looked. There are no paintings or photographs in our farmhouses amongst the hills. I haven't even heard her described to me. I believe I was never good enough to be told these things. Therese decided that I was a lump of wickedness, and now she believes that I will lose my soul altogether unless I take some steps to save it. Well, I have no particular taste that way. I suppose it is annoying to have a sister going fast to eternal perdition, but there are compensations. The funniest thing is that it's Therese, I believe, who managed to keep me out of the presbytery when I went out of my way to look in on them on my return from my visit to the quartal reel last year. I couldn't have stayed much more than half an hour with them anyway, but still I would have liked to get over the old doorstep. I am certain that Therese persuaded my uncle to go out and meet me at the bottom of the hill. I saw the old man a long way off, and I understood how it was. I dismounted at once and met him on foot. We had half an hour together walking up and down the road. He is a peasant priest, he didn't know how to treat me. And of course I was uncomfortable too. There wasn't a single goat about to keep me in countenance. I ought to have embraced him. I was always fond of the stern, simple old man. But he drew himself up when I approached him, and actually took off his hat to me. So simple as that. I bowed my head and asked for his blessing. And he said I would never refuse a blessing to a good legitimist. ... so stern as that. And when I think that I was perhaps the only girl of the family or in the whole world that he ever in his priest's life patted on the head. When I think of that I... I believe at that moment I was as wretched as he was himself. I handed him an envelope with a big red seal which quite startled him. I had asked the Marquis de Villeroy to give me a few words for him, because my uncle has a great influence in his district. And the Marquis penned with his own hand some compliments, and an inquiry about the spirit of the population. My uncle read the letter, looked up at me with an air of mournful awe, and begged me to tell His Excellency that the people were all for God, their lawful king and their old privileges. I said to him then, after he had asked me about the health of His Majesty in an awfully gloomy tone, I said then, there is only one thing that remains for me to do, Uncle, and that is to give you £2 of the very best snuff I have brought here for you. ... What else could I have got for the poor old man? I had no trunks with me. I had to leave behind a spare pair of shoes in the hotel to make room in my little bag for that snuff. And fancy, that old priest absolutely pushed the parcel away. I could have thrown it at his head, but I thought suddenly of that hard, prayerful life, knowing nothing of any ease or pleasure in the world, absolutely nothing but a pinch of snuff now and then. I remembered how wretched he used to be when he lacked a copper or two to get some snuff with. My face was hot with indignation, but before I could fly out at him, I remembered how simple he was. So I said with great dignity that as the present came from the king, and as he wouldn't receive it from my hand, there was nothing else for me to do but to throw it into the brook, and I made as if I were going to do it too. He shouted, "Stay, unhappy girl! Is it really from His Majesty, whom God preserve?" ... I said contemptuously, "Of course." ... He looked at me with great pity in Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.